I'm Christopher Lighton, studying this age of Obama as if it were literature, where every word tells you something, with the Sterling Professor of English at Yale, David Brumwich. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one's with a commentator on our imperial adventure from a fresh angle I've come to rely on. David Brumwich is not a retired general, not a policy wonk of any kind. His gift and his training are not for scoring the healthcare fight day to day, but for parsing epic texts with an eye on characters and plot, rhetoric and ideas, and crucially, words that bear the closest examination. David Brumwich's Obama Watch and his meticulous New York Times Watch are staples now in the Huffington Post and the London Review of Books. He received me in his office on the Yale campus in New Haven. What's so strikingly different about your commentary, David Brumwich, is that it's not political analysis or press criticism. It's a kind of reading of a novel or a literary text for some much deeper signals, emotional, historical, use of language, this kind of thing. And maybe you ought to just read a fragment of what we're both talking about.
And I wouldn't want to say that it is more than press criticism. It's rhetorical analysis of the words that go down in the press that gives us the news about the wars and about the change in American mores towards civil liberties since 2001 and so on. The difference may be in my way of doing it. I tend to pick out phrases as well as, you know, look for a conjunction or a convergence of articles and what that may be saying. I guess what I would have thought good press criticism of an earlier time by people like Mencken and A.J. Liebling looked at the overall character of this or that paper, characterized individual columnists and so on. And I do that, but in some of the columns you're talking about, like the one I just mentioned on the 5 days of the New York Times in October, I'm also picking out details the way maybe literary critics do a little more. I mean, I can give you an example, not from the Times here, but since I brought it along, a pretty good article by Lawrence Wright about Gaza, published in the current issue of The New Yorker. You know, here's a sentence, for example, that caught my eye. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, 96% of Gaza's industrial sector collapsed after Operation Cast Lead, which was the Israeli assault on Gaza in December and January. Well, you notice the phraseology, the choice of the word there, the industrial sector collapsed after the Israeli attack. What if he had written, Israel destroyed 96% of Gaza's industries? That's the same statement, and that's what he means. But it's introduced by the anticlimactic qualifying clause according to the Red Cross. It's a good enough source not to source, but he chooses to do it. And then it begins with the 96%, which is a little abstracting. And then the verb, it's an active verb that sort of denies agency. The industrial sector collapsed after the attack. Well, it didn't just collapse after the attack. The attack destroyed it. Now, that's a choice a writer makes. I'd be hard-pressed in this instance to say quite whether he did it consciously or not. But he didn't want to, in this story, which is at least wanting to be impartial as far as a mainstream American reporter is likely to want to be impartial about Israel and the Palestinians, he didn't want to seem to accuse Israel in any way. So he chose that active-seeming verb, collapsed, and omitted any inference that the reader might want to make about purposeful destruction.
Inferences that the reader had probably already made intuitively anyway.
Maybe, but it matters. It matters whether we see A doing X to B or B suffering Y, parenthesis, because of A. It matters. It matters in the way it gets into your mind.
Give a Times example.
In today's Times, which I happen to bring along to, I don't know that I have an example quite as patent as that, but story on the same subject, actually, by Ethan Bronner and Mark Landler about a top Palestinian rules out race for re-election. It's about Mahmoud Abbas saying that he is so disappointed with the failure of Israel to freeze its settlements that he's not going to run for president. The way in which the discontent of the Palestinian Authority leadership is portrayed is made to have nothing to do with Israeli politics and nothing quite to do with an objective disappointment that anyone can see from Obama's promise to end settlement expansion to Abbas's pulling away from the presidential election. But it has to do with the mood of the Palestinians. You get this in the third paragraph. Mrs. Clinton's visit, which she characterized as a success, sowed anger and confusion among Palestinian and other Arabs after she praised as unprecedented the offer by the Israeli prime minister and so on. Those words, anger and confusion, though it's an unimpeachable statement. There's nothing false about it. But anger and confusion are very conventional traits for us Americans to hear ascribed to Arabs. Arabs are passionate, they're jumpy, their thought process isn't as clear as that of many in the West, perhaps. And when they're angry, they're confused, and when they're confused, they're angry. Words like anger and confusion, which might also be applied to Israelis, are almost never going to appear in the New York Times to characterize an Israeli politician. So those are just by the way choices. There's no falsification. I would even say there's no distortion in the sentence I just read, but there are choices being made that cumulatively have an effect.
Mm. Your assembly of so many of these stories led to a remarkable piece in the London Review of Books in which you said, at least to this reader, me, that the commitment to Afghanistan is already made, and that not just the Pentagon, but the New York Times, the Israel lobby, probably the Clintons, all sorts of other elements of the Obama administration have in fact crossed that Rubicon. Explain how you came to that conclusion, which I must say kind of chilled me.
The immediate sign for me was when Gordon Brown came through with a request, requested 500 additional troops from Britain. This was about a week before I sent in that piece to the London Review of Books. And I just thought the Americans wouldn't embarrass our British allies in this way. If Brown is sending in more troops, it is a sure thing that Obama will come through with more troops. He's not going to let Brown go out on a limb, promise 500 troops, and then say, oh, no, we didn't really want it. You didn't have to do that. So I think it was the fact that some are going to be added by the Obama administration seemed to me pretty well certain. Then, when I was in Colorado Springs in February, a taxi driver told me that the town is doing very well now in spite of the bad times. And I asked why. And he said, well, 40,000 troops just came in. And I said, well, what are these 40,000 troops about? You notice how that number corresponds to a number we're hearing now. And he said, they're training in the mountains. They're training for Afghanistan. Now, that was in February. So, you know, it's so to speak, a secret in plain view. And I would be encouraged to see President Obama signal a change of direction by not adding very many troops, by not going along with the request of his secret ops general, who is now in charge in Afghanistan, General McChrystal. But I think just by delaying with the signals he has sent already, he has given an indication that he'll be pursuing roughly the same direction of policy, but maybe with a slightly different emphasis than before.
There's another point here that's a kind of cultural comment, but a piece you wrote arguing that something fundamental has happened in this country. We have accepted a culture of permanent war.
Yes.
That is quite unlike anything you and I grew up in.
Yes.
Spell it out.
Well, I teach courses on literature and on, you could call it, political thought. I'm co-teaching a course on the career of Lincoln now. And when I talk to students, I notice, just in the course of conversation, when they do get onto contemporary affairs, that the idea that the United States is at war, and that's just the way things are for this great country, and that we're likely to be at war for the indefinite future, that assumption is in them. So it's not this war or the war as it might have been during the Vietnam War or even during Ronald Reagan's covert intervention in Nicaragua. It's war. The United States and war. That's one of the ways that I believe our moral and political sensibilities have been altered in the last few years. But one could trace it in other shifts too. I am still amazed when I think of the fact that at least a great many Americans, a significant and publicly legitimate plurality of Americans, if not a majority, have come to accept the idea that torture is something that we do. I grew up in this country in the 50s, and torture was uniquely associated with the Nazis and with the Japanese in the Second World War. And as you know, there were Japanese officers who were sentenced to many years in prison, and I think in some cases to capital punishments for torture. It was a completely forbidden idea, and it had been, of course, going from Washington to Lincoln, who said that military necessity does not justify cruelty, on up to our own time. But the change in policy under Cheney and the advice of the officers, the lawyers from the Office of Legal Counsel in 2001, 2002, and then the strange, open, almost bland and conventionalized public debate we held in the usual channels on the talk shows, on the pundit shows, about should we torture or should we not? And the proposal of a man like Alan Dershowitz that it should be, quote, brought within the law, by which he meant we should break the law out of itself so as to include torture, and that we encourage the issuing by judges of torture warrants. This is a whole new language and a new set of assumptions, and to me, indicative of one of the ways in which, you know, an extraordinarily ambitious and dangerous-minded man like Dick Cheney has been able to influence American political and moral culture. I just don't think the idea that we would be at war for more than a generation, we would have some enemy or other, or the idea that we just do practice torture because that's what you do when your back is against the wall, those things seem to me non-American, un-American, unimaginable before 10 years ago.
Mm. Come back to the Bromwich technique, which leaps somehow off the page as different. You're not a retired general. You're not a foreign policy analyst or former ambassador. You have none of those pretensions. It's basically a literary scholar here saying, read more carefully, Americans.
Yeah, I'm a
citizen.
They're
not telling you even the point.
I'm a citizen, too. And one of the influences on my writing, undoubtedly, is Thomas Paine. His books, Common Sense and The Rights of Man, had a great effect on me for the way they analyze closely the assumptions behind statements by men of power. And, you know, Edmund Burke, Paine's rival on the French Revolution, is another influence just for that way of looking closely at what's behind.
You are a Burke scholar, after all.
Yes. I've done an anthology of his writings, yeah.
The close reader, in your case, sees things that we hadn't seen before, and I'd love you to explain that.
Well, for example, I wrote one in a different format than usual after President Obama gave his National Archives speech earlier this year. That
yes.
was in May 21st, I think. And that one I did as a series of interrogations. I picked out, that really was like textual criticism. I was picking out a sentence or a phrase from his speech and, you know, spelling out what it really meant or asking questions about it. One piece of usage that I noticed in that speech was Obama saying that his paramount duty as president was to assure the safety of the American people. Now, I noticed that because I had noticed a few years earlier, coming into our speech of President Bush's phraseology about protecting the American people. Bush said, and said it often, that my main job is to protect the American people. I forget if he used the word protector. I don't think he did. But protection, protect, safety, those words all came into his way of talking about his duties. What were his primary duties as the leader of a free people? Well, of course, the oath of office of the presidency does not say anything about safety. The president swears to see that the laws be faithfully upheld. In fact, the president is there most of all to assure that the Constitution is kept in practice. The word safety, except as a sort of emergency exception word, is rare around the time of the Constitution. The word liberty and imposition against liberty, those are much more frequent. So here was Obama acquiescing in Bush's language in that National Archives speech, which was intended to parry and deflect charges made against him by Dick Cheney. And I thought it was a very revealing thing to say. He didn't use up front with the same prominence. He did not use words like liberty, justice, or rights. He used the word safety. I found that disturbing, and so I wrote a whole column with five or six passages, and I think italicized a series of sentences and interrogatories under them. This way of handling political speech or political writing is maybe foreign to our times, but it was not so foreign to the 18th century. I mean, you'll find it not just in the two writers I mentioned, but in lots of the pamphlet war writers of this of 1750s, 1760s, 1770s. Joseph Priestley is another fine practitioner of that art. Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote a book on the French Revolution against Burke, asks him rhetorical questions in much the same way, direct addresses. So, you know, it's part of a more active and vigilant civic culture of politics. And I guess I would say I'm writing as a citizen, but one who's looking at words closely.
That archive speech was a response to Cheney's defiant defense of torture and extreme measures, et cetera, in the Bush administration. What would you have had Obama say at that moment?
That's a very good question. He had said in answer to an interviewer's question from one of the networks, and it may have been John King, and I remember listening to it and saying, there could not be a better answer. One of Obama's good moments, a sort of just coming out with it, moderate-minded but very exact statement of what is wrong with torture, why it is unjust, but why it also alienates potential friends and intensifies the hatred of actual enemies against us. If he had answered in that tenor, which he obviously knew how to do, I think the speech would have been strong, but he was very keen at that time to reassure people who were worried about what would be done with the Guantanamo prisoners that he wouldn't do anything hasty or rash to set free terrorists who might be dangerous to America. So he was balancing way over on that side, I suppose, to try to rescue the idea of closing Guantanamo. But as I think Obama's tendency is, he was placating, he was conciliating, he was reassuring people who do not begin by sharing a great many premises with him. And I should say one thing about his political temperament that I regret, but I think it is part of his temperament and it's not likely to change much, is that he works locally, works in close, as they say in some sports, and tends to build up his policies from responses to the responses to his first assertion of his ideal policy. The other way of going about being the leader of public opinion that a president can be would be Lincoln's way, and that is to educate public opinion in a single direction with simple but memorable principles that you mean to pursue, and educate people about the history of how we arrived at those principles, and then don't alter a whit from the principle you laid down once you've made sure that it is one many people could subscribe to. The curious thing about Obama, who can be very deliberate and very thoughtful, is that he has not done that kind of education. There has been no major speech on the economy. There has been no major speech except the polemical reply to Cheney in that very indirect way, which was the National Archives speech. There has been a major speech on the Middle East. That was the Cairo speech, and a very fine and carefully thought through utterance. But it turned out that it was, in his way of working it, just an idea. at the time. He didn't have an idea, for example, of what he would do if Israel refused to freeze its settlements. There was no sanction to back that pledge he made. So in some way that I can't quite sort out yet watching him, I don't see what he understands the relationship of principle to political action to be. And I wonder at the form of public education he is working at as president. And to go back to an obvious thing, I mean, the lack of a major speech, of one major and memorable speech, it would have had to be a long speech on the economy any time in his first 3 months in office seems to me an extraordinary lapse.
What might it have said at a moment when the masters of capitalism are more worried than they want to admit?
Well, I think if he wants to live up to the standard of Lincoln, which he sometimes invokes, he has to be more honest than the masters of capitalism that he's keeping around him. And if he wants to justify the policy of advisors like Lawrence Summers and Timothy Geithner, he has to speak from their point of view, but then speak from a regulative and more ideal point of view that he holds as well. He needed to tell Americans what was happening to the economy, why it was happening, what interest he had in, you know, guarding against too severe and continuous a loss of jobs, why the stimulus package seemed completely necessary, and that might have even led to asking for a larger one, and why the banks were being bailed out. That last, I think, would have been the hardest to defend. But there should have been a continuous argument developed in a speech on the economy early. The lack of such a statement, I think, opened the way for the almost random but cumulative accusations of people on the far right, the radio talk shows, and so on, which, again, he's had to respond to locally, but not in a single concerted gesture.
David Bromwich, you have enough confidence with language that you did a remarkable thing on the death of William Safire, the longtime columnist and language commentator. You attacked him head-on as a propagandist from the beginning, an advertising guy. A nice guy, as I can testify myself. He was a colleague in the Times Bureau back in the 70s. But it was an angle on American commentary that was nowhere to be found anyplace else, except in your voice on the Huffington Post. Make that case.
Well, Safire introduced a certain tone into column writing, especially the formal, ceremonious sort of column writing the Times seemed to want to foster over more than one generation. A tone that was new, it was jumpy, it was cute, punning, flippant, full of gags, and at the same time, jabbing, highly aggressive. Aggressive not only in its willingness to attack people personally for corruption, in some cases justified, in some cases, as it turned out, not justified, but aggressive in the sense of bellicose, that is, it pushed America into any number of stances that might have led to wars, and some of which did lead to wars. I said in that column that I thought Safire's greatest disappointment was that he did not succeed in pushing Jimmy Carter into bombing the cities of Iran. But anyone who read the Times in those years, in 1979, 1980, remembers just how hard Safire was pushing and what accusations of a lack of feeling for his own country he was making against Carter to try to get us to bomb Iran. This swaggering, you know, war brokering stance in an opinion maker is something that I detest as such. But Safire, by the appearance of good nature, by the jokiness of his column, seemed to make it normal, seemed to make it all right. And I think he had a demoralizing effect on the New York Times.
Spell that out a little bit. I mean, I'm very much inclined to agree, but my perspective on Bill Safire, not only he was a nice guy for, you know, a lunch at the delicatessen, but it was extraordinary to have a figure in that authority come right out of the Nixon speechwriting ranks.
Right.
While the Watergate, you know, fire was still burning.
Right, and right out of the Nixon ranks when Nixon had followed the plan mapped out by Pat Buchanan around 1970, that if we tear the country in two, we can walk away with a larger half. You know, Buchanan was the strategist, but Sapphire was the executant as speechwriter to a great extent, and not for Nixon only, but for Agnew. So, I mean, the Times, by doing that, and remember, the Times in these years was much more courageous than it has been since. I mean, it was the Pentagon, the Times of the Pentagon Papers. But not long after that, you get a vice president, who's later driven out of office for corruption, saying that news coverage is being rendered partial by commentary being smuggled into the news itself, this so-called analysis. And Agnew denounces the mainstream media for lack of balance. And this began what we're still living with the effects of, which I think has watered down the quality of all commentary and really demoralized the character of people who go into journalism, too. The idea that all you need to do in interview journalism, in radio and TV journalism, is say, what do you think? How do you feel about that, Mr. Crystal? Or how do you feel about that, Mr. Frank? And you just ask back and forth and sit there and adjudicate, or seem to adjudicate, the way a moderator of a debate, and a not very hearty moderator of a debate, might do. If you took a comparison from, you know, BBC World News and the really sharp-witted reporters there, at least as of a few years ago when they were working there more, people like Judy Swallow or Owen Bennett Jones, the contrast is staggering. The British journalists keep up with politics and know how to ask very sharp questions, and they pursue. They don't let somebody get away with an evasion. Whereas, you know, the laziness of American interview journalism, and PBS is one of the worst offenders. Jim Lehrer is one of the very worst offenders, one of the laziest that there is simply to ask and ask the way anybody might do. All you really need to do is know the name of the person you're interviewing and know the names of the two people you're having comment from one side or the other. That's a long digression from Sapphire having written speeches for Agnew that got us into this balanced journalism. But I guess my animus against Sapphire, even after his death, comes from the thought that he didn't care about truth much. He cared about pushing his own side of things. And that's what a columnist is supposed to do. But there is a fair-minded pursuit of that and unfair-minded. And Sapphire never, to me, represented any principle of real disinterestedness or probity. So the influence that he's had at the Times in particular among columnists, I would confine more to something stylistic. The writers there use a much more joshing, easygoing, colloquial, almost as if they're on the phone with you tone of voice than their predecessors a generation earlier would have done. That's not true of all of them equally, but you know, you can see the effects of the Sapphire style very much in a writer like Thomas Friedman. So, I mean, he did something, I think, by his example to the mores of American journalism, and I think the Times did something to itself by legitimating him.
There's a clarity in your conclusions, David, that I don't find almost any place else.
Well, I'm not trying to be appointed to write for any other outfit than the one I write for, and I get to say exactly what I think when I write for a place like the London Review or for the Huffington Post. So that may be part of it. I mean, maybe the fact that I'm an outsider and, as I was saying, trying to write with a perspective of a civic-minded American thinking about public issues gives me a certain freedom. I think also I talk about, maybe even I make a point sometimes of talking about, the characters of politicians and their motives. And I am willing to make inferences from a pattern of actions to the probable motives. So, for instance, in the passage that you just read out, it was clear to many people, I think, during the election campaign that Obama was taking a calculated risk when he said that Iraq was the wrong war, but Afghanistan was the right war. He said it, clearly, rhetorically speaking, for the purpose of reassuring the military establishment and reassuring independent voters who liked the idea of this country asserting itself in some war somewhere, we can't back out of them all at once, that he was, in fact, a president willing to wage war. But he did that without a great deal of detailed knowledge about Afghanistan and without a great deal of thought. He just found himself repeating it so often that finally he took on trust the truth of what he heard himself saying. But it turns out that the Afghanistan war was getting much worse at a rapider rate than he imagined. And now he's in this trap, which his own rhetorical situation as a politician, once he reached the general election, has put him into.
For me, you've come to be a very, very subtle explainer of what might be going on in the man.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've never met him. I've only met a couple people who knew him reasonably well in his Chicago days in Hyde Park. But I take him to be essentially temperate, moderate-minded, conciliatory person in public life. And his professed desire for bipartisanship was another mark of this general temperateness and conciliatoriness of character. So, I mean, it seems to me fair to think that, you know, he's not a swaggerer. He is not a reckless and rash and uncomprehending person as his predecessor in office was. But nor is he someone who will stake his second term on a radical position of reorienting the United States' stance toward the whole world. He will speak that line, and he will go as far with it as he can. But, you know, his own metaphor for it, I think, is revealing. He says what he's trying to do to American foreign policy is turning a very large ship around in the water. The metaphor, I think, is imprecise, because if he were turning it around, that would be to suggest that he wants the United States to cease to be an imperial power altogether, and he is sailing us back home. I would alter the metaphor if I were trying to capture accurately what he's doing and say he's slowing the ship down and asking us to look at what the port is we're headed towards, but we're still sailing in the same direction, more slowly, with a captain who seems much more in possession of rational faculties. But he is a captive of the inertia of the use of American power that he inherits, and he has done nowhere near as much as some of us hoped he might do to explain the logic of a very different policy. So I'm just watching and hoping and waiting for encouragement, but what we see thus far gives grounds for only very mild feelings of encouragement.
Put all the Bromwich clues together, where do you think we're going?
Well, on the evidence that I mentioned before, I think he's going to go forward and add some troops. He's going to do that so as not to have a general's revolt to deal with. And, you know, an interesting recent article in Rolling Stone by Robert Dreyfus talked about just this as a potential obstacle to Obama's foreign policies in general. The military officers at the Pentagon are displeased at the idea that there might be a serious revaluation of American policy going on. I don't think he wants to give them displeasure. I do think he
what
wants...
What would a general's revolt look like in this country?
That's really very unclear. Nathaniel Fick cited in an article by Elizabeth Boumiller in the New York Times, and I quoted that in the piece that I mentioned at the start of this interview, said that, you know, there's something brewing. It's like thunder out there, maybe lightning. I hope it really comes to nothing. What one knows is that these people have been fed a very rich diet by Bush and Cheney, and that Obama is somewhat cutting back their diet. And that is a powerful part of American society. We have a military industrial security state to an extent most Americans don't really imagine. They're a tremendous amount of our budget. We spend as much on defense as the rest of the world put together. They know it, and they consider themselves the leading edge of the country. And if Obama disappoints them gravely, they will somehow make him feel it. One way they could make him feel it is for the ambitious General David Petraeus, who is also articulate, to set himself up to be a candidate for the presidency. I don't think that's likely to happen, but it's not impossible. And you read out the bit about Robert Dole with his usual mischief, hoping that Petraeus might be a Republican candidate. So I think Obama's working to parry all of those possibilities, and he is going, therefore, to satisfy the generals in some way. He's going to add some troops. I would guess not too much fewer than 40,000, but we'll see. But I would guess that he's also going to satisfy the advice he's getting for a change of direction from Vice President Biden. We wouldn't have been hearing so much about Biden's advice to pursue a war on the borders and to pull into the cities and not try to convert the populace to the American way of making a country by counterinsurgency. We wouldn't have been hearing so much about that Biden argument unless the White House wanted us to be hearing that. So my guess is that there will be an escalation of some extent that can't be called, you know, paltry. And there will be, at the same time, to justify all this reappraisal, there will be the announcement of a change of direction. But, you know, with regret, I say that is nowhere near changing the total direction of American policy in Afghanistan. And it does look like being a policy that can't do the things that were promised a few years ago.
Would you give us your own notes as a language man about the language of this moment, this era, this discourse, especially about Afghanistan, but in general, what do you observe? Play Bill Sapphire for a moment yourself.
No, I won't. But I will tell you what I think has happened to the American language about politics in general, and that is that it has gotten softer, lost its edge, become euphemistic to a great extent. And I wrote an article, I guess about a year and a half ago, in the New York Review of Books called Euphemism and American Violence that talks about this in some detail and with some illustrations. One example I used in that essay was the talk in Iraq with all the large losses of American troops coming in 2006, 2007. We're seeing an uptick of violence, or we're seeing a slight uptick of violence. That word uptick is, you know, sort of spiffy, it's sort of casual, it's sort of everyday conversation, but at the same time, it's bureaucratic, impersonal. It sounds like it's saying something rather precise, but it's saying nothing. What it's doing is not getting our eyes too close onto the violence. David Brooks, in his column, sometimes talks about the enemies of American troops in Iraq or Afghanistan as bad guys. That's a locution that belongs, as I know from a family relation, to prosecutors' offices and police departments. It's a sort of gentle cowboy language used by people who are used to fighting crime. They're the good guys and the bad guys, and they want to keep it straight and simplify it. So just among themselves, cops or prosecutors talk about the bad guys. For a serious political commentator to talk about guerrilla resistance to the American occupying force in Iraq as, quote, bad guys, it seems to me a failure of the duty to educate one's readers. Characterize them more, say what is bad or wrong or evil about them. But, you know, that's an example of a softening kind of locution that's very common all over the press these days. An example of softened language to the point of not being able to say what we even mean is the American diplomatic response to defiance by allies who are not obeying our policy directives. And the phrase now being used all the time is not helpful. That's not helpful. I'm not sure that doesn't go beyond diplomacy into a sort of flaccidness that suggests just lack of will or self-conception. But that kind of locution, that not helpful, it's all over bureaucratic. It's all over academic language, too. It comes from speech codes. It comes from political correctness, initiated, I think, by the left much more than the right. But now the left is the victim of it. As we see, we even lack the words to describe the things we detest from a radical point of view.
What's it like to be a fixture now of the Huffington Post?
Well, I would like to be a fixture not forever. And what will stop me is a real turning around of the boat and bringing back home of this country to its traditions on civil liberties and of only necessary wars, one at a time and sometimes no war. But there doesn't seem any prospect of that soon. I think one of the purposes of writing can be to make people not feel that they are alone in anomalous or strange reactions to things, which are in fact not strange at all, but they may not find the company to speak it in. And one thing that writing has always done, one thing publication has always done, is to make the world of honest opinion, honest reaction, whatnot, a little less small. So I felt, I guess, in this writing more than most things I do, that kind of effect sometimes.
Once upon a time, a Yale professor of literature might be writing op-eds on this kind of thing in the New York Times. Now you're writing about the Times in the Huffington Post with the bark on.
I have written op-eds for the New York Times. I think about four or five over many years, including one on Nicaragua way back in the 80s. And I don't, in spite of appearances in this interview and in some of the columns, I don't have a particular grievance or have it in for the Times. But they are an important mainstream paper, and the way they bent towards the war on Iraq, I think, was all important in legitimating that war. So they bear watching, and when no one else is minding that watch, I do it. So I've written about half a dozen columns to that effect, yeah.
They're hugely interesting in a voice that I don't hear anyplace else. I look for them now, and I'm very, very grateful for your work. I'm grateful for this conversation.
Thank you. Same here.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with David Bromwich. Ben Mandelkern recorded it. Respond to the Word Man's take, please, with your own close reading of Barack Obama's rhetoric and David Bromwich's at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.